full moon from California. No reason why not. I was lost, but I hadn't left the planet. I had just quit indulging in hope for the future. I wandered instead in the underworld of the past, and on one of these nights I remembered my father, just before he died, picking me up from a guitar lesson wearing his clothes from work, chewing a toothpick, brutally distracted behind a pair of plastic sunglasses. In spite of his mood, he was full of enthusiasm for something I had written to commemorate my sixth grade graduation. Those few sentimental lines had melted him. He wanted a copy. I can't remember what they said. But this memory in Somalia disrupted the story I had continued to tell myself all these months and years about our relationship. I wondered if we would have fought like hell over my career. Not loving enough was the crucial failure, like not appreciating the moon. I never told Dad how much I wanted him home when I was 12, because I was 12, and because I had no idea that I would see him again maybe 4, maybe 5 times more in my life. His alcoholic sense of waste in Northridge must have been a powerful distraction from the simple thrill of living. My childhood memories were charged with that thrill. The dry tedium of the suburbs hadn't beaten it down. It occurred to me in Somalia that I lacked my father's problem. I was learning to thrive in an ugly atmosphere. In spite of foul circumstances, I had found a way to live. It's still hard to describe. Dad's disillusion sounded like bare-knuckled realism, but it proved to be a stubborn chemical ignorance of a beauty that surrounded us every day. Northridge, after all, could also be beautiful, a once fertile part of Southern California still dotted with sycamores, pines, and liquid amber trees, even cactus and banana trees. It had wildlife, possums and cougars, rattlesnakes and owls. The relative bleakness of Somalia had revived colorful memories of an awkward American boyhood, a chorus of strange people and cracked asphalt schoolyards, graceless restaurants, dusty baseball diamonds, of polluting cars and stifling schoolrooms that were beautiful too. And this weird superhuman beauty, like the power of the sun, had not even wavered when Dad shot himself in the chest. After one of these horrible nights, I woke up feeling shaken, frightened, but somehow cleaned out. I remembered that one point of a sublime poem by St. Francis called The Canticle of Brother Sun and Sister Moon was love for the unlovable, an opening of the soul toward beauty as well as the ugly abomination of death. A pirate tossed the clinking keys. I unlocked my chains and shuffled to the bathroom. I came back and waited for breakfast. Bashko, replacing the night shift guard, delivered my ration of beans and sat against the wall, wrapped in a sarong. He listened to news on his phone. A few stray flies showed an early morning interest in the sugared beans. I waved them off.
"Michael," said Bashko after a while, "America? No money?"
I didn't want to talk about it.
"Burad, finished," he went on.
"Pirates are done for."
"Oh, yeah?" "Burad, no ships," he said, cryptically.
I shrugged and finished eating, then retreated under my mosquito net and listened to the radio. Bashko had placed his finger on an unpleasant fact. One reason I'd languished so long in Somalia was the decline of piracy off the coast. The Nahum III turned out to be the second-to-last vessel hijacked during the dramatic upswing in Somali piracy, the heyday between 2005 and 2012, and now the bosses invested money elsewhere, in foreign real estate, drug running, weapons smuggling, even human trafficking. Shipowners now sent cargo vessels past Somalia with armed teams on board. Navies were helping to keep the peace. Hijackings off Somalia had all but ended in 2013 and 14, and the gangs clung to what they had, including me. On the radio, I heard about a UN report announcing precisely what I had flown here to investigate, that piracy in Somalia had employed thousands of people in certain regions and towns. Illicit business had attracted capital to industries like boat repair, restaurants, and housing, and I wondered if turning the illicit movement of goods into something legitimate might not be far behind. While I rotted in Galkayo, in fact, work had started on the Hobyo waterfront to build a small port and to grade the dusty bush trails leading from the town. Members of the Galmudug government were even working to renovate Mussolini's farmhouse.
It was a comical act of whitewashing, and I wouldn't learn about it for months, but Hobyo elders and investors had started to convert the ruin where Raleigh and Mark and I had lived into a quasi-government building known as the Villa Galmadug. Also on the radio, I started to hear familiar voices. A Somalia expert I knew from the Hamburg trial, Stig Jarl Hansen, talked about Al-Shabaab. A BBC reporter from Berlin, a friend named Damian McGuinness, now reported from Latvia. People's lives had moved on. Hearing Damien's voice unstuck my habit of resisting hope. It reminded me of busy restaurants in Berlin, of low lights and music, cigarette smoke and half-crumbled East German tenement buildings, especially the bar in one of those buildings where I used to gather friends for casual dinner and drinks. It cracked my practiced indifference to think about that life, and I missed them all with a crushing, lonely desire. Chapter 9. During the first half of 2014, we moved between Abdi Yare's house and Duhul's house every 4 or 5 weeks, depending on aircraft noise, and Duhul decided to stash me in the corner of a larger, dimmer room at his house, away from the door, so I no longer had a view of the sky. My guards shut the bottom half of the steel shutters in this room all day long, so I had to squint when I wanted to read or write. At night, they closed the shutters completely. I thought my colorful clothes could still flag the attention of planes, so I did laundry often. The outdoor bathroom at Duhul's was a semi-detached chamber with no windows, and the pirates had to stand in the yard holding Kalashnikovs while I plunged my shorts and soccer jersey into a bucket of water and sudsed them up with Topomol. Sometimes, they wouldn't let me out because of a plane in the sky. I started to wonder if the presence of armed men in the yard on its own was a clue to my location. Laundry became a comforting ritual. My brain wandered to strange places while my hands did the work. Every African I'd met, Raleigh as well as the pirates, referred to Topomol detergent as Omol, which struck me as weird because the company promoted the opposite nickname on each plastic satchel, Top. I remembered Ahmed Dirie sitting under a thorn tree one afternoon in the bush, staring at a plastic satchel of the powder and coming up, finally, with Top, which produced a rotten-toothed grin of surprise as if he'd never studied the package before. It dawned on me during a laundry session that they were echoing Omo, a brand of detergent African kids grew up with from Senegal to the Seychelles. That made me think about the pop cultural power of a simple brand of soap, which reminded me of old Ajax detergent ads in the United States. They predated my childhood, but they'd left such an impression on a generation of American kids that both Tom Waits and Jim Morrison had made fun of the jingle in their songs. The old black-and-white commercials featured a knight in shining armor riding to the rescue of plumbers, diner cooks, and suburban housewives, while a jarring, ridiculous chorus in the background saying, "Stronger than dirt, stronger than dirt." I hummed this jingle to myself while I worked. One day, Bashko denied me permission to wash my clothes. "Tomorrow," he said, but the next day he also said no. This petty restriction moved me to rage. It eroded my slim but established set of rights. I stood up to mount a protest on my woven plastic exercise mat. I said, "Washy wash," in the same calm and patient tone I used to insist on trips to the bathroom before dawn. The tone must have irritated Madobi because he stepped over in a quick fury to pull the mat from under my feet. I went straight down. Most of my weight landed hard on my twisted right leg, and there was an intense pain from the top of my shin to my ankle, like a crack in wood. I took this rich opportunity to yell and swear. Bashko hollered back, brandishing his rifle. He ordered me to sit on my mattress in silence, and my next trip to the bathroom involved an excruciating limp. By dinner time, I had declared a hunger strike. "No chum chum," said Bashko when he tried to serve me food. "No chum chum," I said, "because Madobe." He sighed and left the room. These strikes were a ritual now, like the laundry. Bashko and the other guards pretended not to care. But the next day, after I refused a second meal, they asked for my demands. "I must see a doctor," I said and pointed at my shin. "X-ray." Any clinic in Galkayo with an X-ray machine would have to be run by a real doctor. I doubted the pirates would present me to one. But I saw good reason to hold out for a demand just beyond the boss's reach. I wanted to force them to let me go. This cloudy design was a far more serious proposition than protesting a missing bowl of beans, and it had to be approached with care, since the bosses would shut down any protest that posed a direct threat to their ransom. I thought a defiant, showy strike would invite beatings or torture, but I could imagine escalating a small misunderstanding to a justified, disciplined protest. From stray reports on the BBC, I had gathered that a human could last a month without food, given water to drink. Without water, I would die in 3 days. I wondered if the pirates would confiscate my liquids. But the injury to my leg went against every rule, as Duhol and Madobe both understood. I navigated the first day with water, tea, milk, and mango juice. I just rationed supplies. Half a bottle of juice and one cup of milk per day, plus one bottle of water, felt right. I could anticipate the gnawing hunger, and I handled the panic. On the second day, I felt a heavy, hollow depression from the moment I woke up to pee. The panic returned. My brain went groping for a way to rationalize my self-starvation, but all it found was a stubborn refusal to let Madobe off the hook. By the end of the third day, the men had begun to worry. Abdul, the effeminate guard, came in to hand me a greasy package of sambusi. "No," I said. "No problem," he whispered. "Our little secret." He motioned for me to hide them, so I ate one and hid the rest. My body sponged up the nutrition, and I felt better for about 2 hours. Abdul and Bashko came in the next morning and said, "Michael, doctor tonight. Chum chum, okay?" "Mm-hmm." It was a ploy, but I noticed my advantage. I had demanded an x-ray. I could take them at their word, eat a snack, and if I still had no x-ray tonight, which seemed unlikely, I could resume the protest in the morning. "Okay," I said, and let them serve me a bowl of beans. My leg had improved, and I knew the bone was only bruised, not fractured. But I limped convincingly to the toilet, which kept Madobe's sarcasm in check. He always watched me with alert, half-mocking eyes for evidence that I was just fine. That evening I went to sleep without knowing the state of my own hunger strike. No doctor had arrived. Bashko pretended we were back to normal in the morning and delivered a bowl of beans. With my stomach rumbling, I said, "No doctor, no chum-chum. Fucking!" The hunger intensified every day. It made me scrappy and mean. During my fierce and starving afternoons, I nursed every old, familiar prisoner's grievance. I resented the guards' resentment. I loathed their guns. I hated their religion. I thought of them as enemies who lived on such a deep circle of hell that they owed me a profound moral debt from the first sluggish hours of the morning when they unlocked my chains, opened the clanking shutters, and granted me permission to pee. These grievances weren't new, but the hunger stripped them raw, and the longer I turned them over in my head, the more I had to face my own mistakes, until the emotional balance I nurtured to survive an average day seemed to burst into black smoke and spiral like a crashing plane. On these occasions, I could screw myself into the ground with memories of my capture in President Aline's car and my warm swim in the ocean off the Naham 3, my feelings of guilt, my suffering mother, my helpless relatives and friends. And this easy lurch from righteous anger to self-recrimination made me rotten-minded with rage. Part of me still begged for vengeance. Part of me still wanted suicide. I still pulled at my chain, psychologically, like a junkyard dog. On day 5, I had to review my motivations. I felt weak. I wanted the struggle to end. The pirates hinted that liberty was imminent. Chum chum, okay. But in my undernourished state, I thought their wispy gossip and promises of freedom were more maddening than the raw passage of time. I learned to listen with distant bemusement, the way an old man watches TV. By day 6, my body had started to consume itself. I looked and felt like a scarecrow. I let Bashko convince me that a doctor would soon pay a visit. He called the runner and ordered sambusi, and I indulged in a greasy feast before bedtime, but I saved one, wrapped in plastic, for the morning. In the morning, I asked Bashko about the doctor. "No doctor," he said. "No chum-chum," I said. "Fucking!" On day 7, I refused breakfast, then lunch. In the afternoon, 2 bosses arrived. Duhol and one elder who went by Abdi Yare came in, looking stern, followed by Yunus and a strange new Somali they introduced as a doctor, a small-featured young man with glasses. He listened while Yunus translated my complaint. He palped my shin and tried to look knowledgeable. But everyone could tell I wanted to hold out for some concession, just as I could tell this young Somali had no medical degree. "The leg is not broken," he said. "You will be fine." He handed me a small pot of tiger balm ointment to rub into my skin. "Okay, Michael," said Eunice. I said nothing. The doctor says you are fine, Eunice insisted, with the bosses staring me down. You do not need an x-ray.
Mm-hmm.
You must eat.
I said nothing.
Chapter 10 Sheer frustration after the failed hunger strike brought me to a pair of contradictory, dead-end realizations, neither one liberating or, in fact, very helpful. The same puzzle had ruled my captivity for more than 2 years, but now I felt it in my gut like the dull point of a pike. I wanted to die. I did not want to die. These feelings were compounded by the blanket of desert heat that pressed on Galkayo during an average afternoon. It is almost impossible to describe the malaise, the very special weariness of spirit, Hanley wrote in Warriors, which eats into one after the 6th month in the midst of the tension and the hot silence. 6 months? I know of 15 cases of madness in that wilderness. Hanley wasn't reassuring to think about, and the worst part about not wanting to die was facing this malaise every day. But my hunger strike had rattled the pirates. It forced them to wonder what might happen if I died and denied them a ransom. Farah, the long guard with a gentle manner, who had a sharp chin and large teeth, seemed impressed with my stamina. One afternoon, while he sat alone on the mat, watching me in the room, he said, 2 years, with a broad, lazy smile, as if he were tired of the routine, too. Adiga.
Ha,
I said. 2 years, he repeated. A bit longer, in fact. By now it was late March 2014. 2 years and 2 months in captivity. Farah kept smiling as if it were some kind of achievement. I liked Farah. He was a lank and quiet man, unsure of his role as a pirate. Sometimes I caught him deep in brooding pleasure over the music he played on his phone. He played Air Oud like a teenager. He followed the twanging notes with his long fingers, nodding his head. And he'd boasted innocently about Kanan as a clan brother, a fellow Sa'ad, before the others had shut him up. In case of a violent rescue, I didn't want Farah to die. In case of a violent rescue, I didn't want me to die. One morning I listened to an hour-long program from Rome about the new pope, Francis. My shortwave was fickle in the hour before the world service. Usually it tuned into Radio Sultanate of Oman, sometimes it preferred Vatican Radio. On this particular morning, I heard Francis compare human sin to the stars, and his simple image had an uncommon persuasion for a hostage lying on the floor of a prison house. At night we look at the sky and we see many stars, his English reporter translated, and in the background I could hear the Pope give his homily in Italian. Tante stelle, tante stelle. But when the sun rises in the morning, the light is such that we can't see the stars. God's mercy is like that, a great light of love and tenderness. This homily was the first stirring and relevant idea I had heard in many months. It reminded me of the unforgiving servant, the petty man in the Gospels who walked into the street after pleading for mercy from a king, only to hassle another servant for a much smaller debt. I noticed that if the pirates were in debt to me morally, then I was in moral debt too. Up to my neck in it, rotten with obligation. To my mom, above all, to my entire family, to all the institutions working to set me free. It would have been idiotic, hypocritical, to maintain some persecuted notion of myself. I was still alive, for one thing. In spite of my nasty circumstances, it struck me as basically good that I hadn't drowned myself off the ship. Therefore, I shouldn't kill myself now. All the personalities, from Epictetus to Primoidia, from Thich Quang Duc to Derek Walcott, who had sustained me so far, all these different ideas of liberation from the self seemed to congeal in the Pope's image of the sun, and a strange feeling of gratitude spread in my blood. I had nothing but a quiet throb of life, which itself was a gift, like the power of thought, and the simple poetry in the Pope's words unfastened something, so I could feel how bitterness and anger were acts of will, like suffering itself, and how a slight step backward, an unhooking of the mind, could let in a flood of mercy and light. Chapter 11 So I called a private truce. I stopped treating the pirates like persecutors. I talked as pleasantly as possible to the men during the daylight hours when we had to sit in a single room among crumpled leaves of cot and kettles of oversweet tea. When they asked for mango juice, I gave them a bottle without wondering to myself why they didn't just go to the goddamn store.
Good
morning, Hashi would say when he opened my steel shutters in the morning.
Suba wanag san, I answered in his language and meant it.
My routine hardly changed. I listened to the radio, I drafted a novel in my notebooks, I raised my voice now and then to let any hypothetical drone discover my location, but I no longer cursed myself or the pirates every morning. My hair and beard were wild as a hobo's with startling new streaks of gray, but I no longer felt the strain coming from within. By now, I had abandoned hope as a decadent indulgence, a fine flapping of the spirit that ended too easily in desolation. When I thought about my friends in Berlin, my family in Cologne, my grandmother in Holland, or my mom and my friends in California, I thought of them as shades from the past. I assumed Mom had packed up my apartment and stuffed everything into storage. I hadn't spoken to her in 14 or 15 months. I knew there was a chance this dim existence in Somalia would end in gunfire, or with an unexpected hostage sale to Al-Shabaab, who wouldn't mind having an American to destroy in public. I assumed the past was gone. I just moved from one moment to the next. Epictetus said in more than one of his lectures that real human freedom is moral choice, the skill to choose good over bad and not to be distracted by impressions. This turned out to be a lot of work. By impressions, he meant not just prejudice, reflex, and the first impressions we all form about strangers, who might be enemies or friends, the usual bending of the light through a cognitive prism that modern psychologists also teach their clients to see, but the basic wrong impression that good and bad can be discovered out there among the hordes of uncontrollable other people. Sectarian strife, dissension, blame and accusation, ranting and raving, they all are mere opinion. The opinion that good and bad lie outside us, Epictetus said. Let someone transfer these opinions to the workings of the will, and I personally guarantee his peace of mind, no matter what his outward circumstances are like. One afternoon, I noticed two guards, Isa and Rashid, absorbed in a movie on a sleek new phone. Everyone else at Dahul's had gone to sleep. The voices of the actors coming from the phone sounded American, and I wondered which American film could hold these men so rapt. The BBC had been full of Oscar coverage of the Tom Hanks movie Captain Phillips, which followed the famous naval standoff between pirates and SEAL snipers in 2009. I listened for a while and thought, fuck me, that's Tom Hanks. Isa, I said with a sour grin. Movie okay? Huh? A week or two later, Farhan, the youthful veteran of Mogadishu, came to squat heavily beside my mattress with the same smartphone. Michael, look, he said, and showed me a scene from Captain Phillips. To my surprise, he handed me the phone. While we watched parts of the movie, early scenes set in Oman and on the cargo ship MV Maersk, Alabama, my nerves woke up from their slumber of the past few months, and an idea arrived with a faint, stirring hope. What if I just called home? The pirates tried to keep their phones out of my reach because they worried about that possibility. Now I concocted a plan to dial Mom's number without alerting Farhan. I'd have to blurt something in German, then I would hang up, pretend I had shouted at the film, and curse and swear and apologize for somehow screwing up the phone. Oh, dang, where'd the movie go? Farhan's number could then be traced from America, and I could be rescued. For the first time in months, I had a real alternative to my dull and hopeless prison life. My heart thudded. It could work, but the idea ran the considerable risk of leaving an American number behind in the phone software, which a pirate might see. Farhan retreated to his mat. He chewed cot and talked with Farah. I found the volume button. To dial a number, I wanted a silent keypad. I killed the volume slowly, waiting for my guards to think about other things. Instead, Farhan blurted, Michael, Problem? Telephone? He said. I don't know. Volume. Yeah. Hit the wrong button, I mumbled. He came over to fix it. Thanks. He returned to his corner and I watched a little more. After a while, he stood up to leave. Farah, who spoke less English, remained in the corner with his pile of cot. Deciding whether to use this tool for my physical freedom was also a moral decision, discerning better from worse. I might die, the guards might die, but those were the terms of our existence here, imposed by my captors. I had not turned into a saint. I fiddled with the volume again. Farah said, Michael, problem.
What?
No problem. Sound? Sound, he said.
Hmm.
The whole house slumbered. Farhan came back, and the guards exchanged words. Farhan, heavy and patient, came to squat on his haunches and stare.
No problem, he said.
No problem, I said. Flies buzzed. Afternoon light poured through the door. Farhan squatted about a yard away. To distract us both from what was on my mind, I pointed at the main Somali character, the pirate who would survive the movie and go on trial in New York.
This Somali, I said.
Farhan nodded. Abdu Wali, he said, referring to the real pirate Abdu Wali Muse.
He is my friend.
Really?
Yes, my clan brother. My friend from childhood.
Darod, I said, referring to the clan. Farhan had said he came from Puntland, where the Darod dominated.
Yes, he said.
Abdu Wali is in America now, I said.
In prison.
Yes. I don't know why Farhan showed me Captain Phillips. I think he was just being kind. It seemed like a morbid film for pirates to watch, since we all knew how it ended. 3 simultaneous bullets from the stern of a warship, 3 mutilated pirates, blood, horror, and a rescued American. No doubt they felt entangled in the same drama. Maybe they were watching for tips. The spectacle of Somalis in a Hollywood film also held a drug-like fascination for them, and smartphones, even more than TV, had delivered the distant, narcotic world of pop culture straight to their hands. After 45 minutes, long before the climactic sniper fire, Farhan grew tired of squatting near my mattress in the buzzing heat, watching me watch the film.
Okay, Michael, he said,
and took his phone away. Chapter 12. One afternoon in May, while I wrote in my notebook, Boshko came in and set a bottle of liquor on the concrete floor with a clink.
Alcohol? I said.
Why?
From Talia, he said, which was our word for Duhol.
Why?
Good, Boshko said.
He lifted his thumb and went away. The bottle, from Ethiopia, had a yellow label showing a juniper bush and a brand name in Amharic, along with the English words dry gin. Duhol drank the same stuff. Since I was working, I saved it for sundown when I would need help falling asleep. The bottle had an electric effect on my guards. Every time a new pirate came in and spotted the rare, clear, potent, forbidden liquor on the floor, he looked unnerved and tempted. A few words exchanged in Somali would explain the mystery, a gift from Duhol, but no guard was immune to the luxurious allure of the gin. First, Abdinur, the machine gunner, came in to beg with a plastic cup.
Sahib, he said in a rough and pleading voice. Aniga, gin, okay.
I laughed and poured him a little. He'd never used the word sahib with me before.
Adiga Muslim, I said.
Aren't you Muslim?
Ha,
he said and downed the shot. Later in the afternoon, Rashid, the pirate princeling, tried his luck.
Sahib, he said.
But Rashid had cheated me out of limes and sambusi and other little treats, and I liked him less than Abdinur. I wagged my finger.
Muslim, no, I teased him, though I knew he wasn't observant.
Sahib, he insisted, no. That evening I mixed a cup of gin with mango juice to drink before going to sleep. It tasted vile. Abdinur came in to wrap the chains around my feet and expressed, in a mixture of Somali and pidgin, that I should be happy about the gift from Duhol, because a bottle of Ethiopian gin could run $20. I felt real surprise.
It shouldn't cost 10, I said.
The next day, the pirates were no less surprised that my gin still existed. Why hadn't the booze-starved Christian emptied his bottle? They paraded in, one by one, to stare or beg for more. I traded Rashid one slug for a lime, and in the evening I asked Boshko to cut my lime in half. I squeezed it into a tin cup of cloying tea from my thermos, and this concoction was tolerable. I made a note. Somali gimlet. One part Ethiopian gin, whole fresh lime, 2 parts sweet black tea. Adjust gin content as necessary. The pirates pooled their allowance to buy gin of their own, and one day, while Duhul was gone, a runner delivered an identical bottle. Abdinur tilted it up to drink in great bubbling gulps. 4 or 5 others gathered around with plastic cups. Boshko and Farah both abstained, at least in front of me. But it was interesting to watch the others abandon Islam for an evening. A few days later, in early June, Hashi woke me up by opening the metal shutters at dawn as usual and said, Michael,
Adiga free.
Hmm?
Today, he answered with the flying airplane hand gesture I had learned to loathe. Adiga free.
Really?
Huh? I went to the bathroom, returned, and ate my bowl of beans. Afterward, Hashi and Bashko both told me to pack.
Why?
Adiga free. Bashko, what's going on? He squatted near my bed and explained that sometime in the afternoon I would be driven to Galkayo, where I would board a plane for Nairobi. I couldn't just sit here with my towel hanging on the shutter, my skin disinfectant on the windowsill, my bottled-up toothbrush and steel cup all waiting on the floor. I had to be ready to leave. I didn't believe him, but over the next hour I watched the pirates pack their own clothes into plastic sacks. My heart started to race. At last I packed my faux leather bag. I even separated a few snacks and mango drinks into a plastic bag as a carry-on. The idea that my ridiculous satchel, which had to be tied with a dirty rope, would survive transshipment in a luggage hold was delusional. But for the first time in months, I allowed myself a few inches of optimism. I imagined a UN plane, a skinny turboprop with a dozen seats. I wondered what to say to strangers. Around noon, Abdul Rahman, the urbane translator, came to Duhul's house with his telephone and showed me a text message in English. Tell Michael we will bring him back to Dunkerstrasse in Berlin. It also gave the correct house number. Astonishing. A current of hope stirred in me again. You must answer this person, said Abdul Rahman. Who is it?
He has come to help you.
He handed me a notebook.
Please write your answer here. I will send it.
I should write to him?
Yes.
But Abdul Rahman didn't want me to type into his phone. He wanted to transcribe the message later and send it from a different location.
I see.
For the rest of the afternoon, Duhul sat with his men on the porch, ruminating over piles of khat. His wooden leg lay next to him on a mat, suited up with a sock and shoe. Duhul's moments of fatherly kindness to his men had a menace that reminded me of Indonesia about 10 years earlier when I had visited a Quran school in Java. It was a plain but sweltering, banana-shaded dormitory where young Muslim radicals had lived with their teacher.
He is not like other leaders, one of the boys had said. He sits and eats his meals with us.
The teacher was a fringe-bearded ally of Al-Qaeda named Abu Bakar Ba'asir, who had masterminded the bloody 2002 bombings in Bali. This implosion of class difference and hierarchy was a technique of pirates throughout history, not just idealistic, not just admirable, but also a simple way for criminal bosses to win the devotion of poor young men. Late in the afternoon, Duhul's phone rang. The last thing I remember hearing from the commander that day was,
Ah, Maya.
No. Night fell, and Hashi came in to wrap the chains around my feet. I asked him, full of fragile and almost childish hope,
Aniga, free?
Huh?
He said.
Tonight!
Chapter 13 I woke up at the first muezzin on the same filthy mattress. I thought I heard the thrum of a drone. The guards acted tense and ignored my requests for more drinking water and shampoo. All morning they maintained an uneasy quiet. In the afternoon I asked permission to use the toilet while Abdunur sat in a chair in my doorway. He just stared into the courtyard and ignored me.
Abdunur, I said. Kadi!
He gave me a filthy look.
What's the problem around here? I said, very loud, which brought Bashko darting into the room with his rifle.
He told me to shut up and argued with Abdunur. For a minute, I watched in disbelief. The pirates were like Keystone Cops. At last my bladder asserted itself.
Kadi!
I roared, and then all the pirates were arguing. They let me walk to the toilet, but I had shattered the uneasy quiet. Hours later, in the dead of night, a car arrived to drive us to Abdi Yare's. The men tossed my things on the floor. They seemed resentful and bitter. When I lowered my mosquito net in the dark, Bashko came in to lock up my chains, and I whispered at him for an explanation.
Because Adiga, he said.
Because of you. The translator and runner at Abdi Yare's house was a slithery, oily man with a long face and close-set eyes. He came in with deliveries of khat and necessities from the market. He looked no older than most of the guards, but acted calm and superior. He did seem well-informed, so I asked Bashko if this man, Hassan, could offer me news. He minced into the room with careful, disparaging eyes, and seemed to answer every note of defiance in my voice with a qualm of infidel hatred.
as if I were too stupid to understand why I had to sit in a room. I asked about our day of near freedom the previous week. "A man came to give us money for you," he said. "His name was Joe. Do you know him?"
"I don't think so."
"He came with $700,000, but we told him the price was $3 million. We told him, go back to your motherland."
"How odd."
"He wore the uniform of your military. You say, fatigues? He came here with 3 people. They did not have proper visas, and we do not know how they entered the country. We referred them to the Minister of the Interior. They were under arrest for 2 days.
"Interior Minister for Galmadug?" I asked.
"Yes."
"Mm-hmm."
"We have evidence he came from Djibouti. We do not know what he intended. He spoke like an American. We think this man was a commando."
"What a peculiar story," I said.
"Do you know him?"
"I don't know anyone named Joe. At least not anyone who would come to Somalia. It did seem possible that a contractor might try to get me out, but I couldn't fathom why someone like that would startle my kidnappers by wearing fatigues. The only fact I could rely on was my street address on Abdurrahman's phone. Someone had spelled it correctly. A pirate wouldn't have been careful about the C in Dunkerstrasse, which suggested that my apartment was intact, which suggested that no one had packed it into storage, which suggested that someone expected me to return, which suggested that my family and friends were more than just shades from the past. The more I wandered down this road in my head, the more the wheel of hope and disappointment racked my emotions, lifting me for a while but leaving me for a while in even worse condition. My guards must have moved through the same cycle. I think it gnawed at their morale to think that a ransom had landed in Galkayo briefly, but flown off again into the clear blue sky.
Chapter 14. When Ramadan started later in the summer, we lived in Duhul's house again, and someone liberated the TV, again, from his bedroom, though not for my benefit. The World Cup was on. The men watched it on the porch. I went to sleep every night with the glare of soccer matches flickering through the door. They played after dark in Somalia, beamed across the planet from Brazil, and since I had to be chained and quiet on my bed by sundown, I followed the tournament every morning on the BBC. World Cup soccer woke up a powerful nostalgia for Berlin. The commotion of a European city during a soccer tournament is unlike anything in America, where people retreat to backyards and living rooms for the Super Bowl or the World Series, leaving the streets deserted. Berliners collect in bars and cafes on summer evenings for the World Cup. Men and women, young and old, to drink and chatter and holler at big outdoor screens. People wander the sidewalks with flags. They chant national songs. When I worked late in my apartment, I could keep an ear on the score just by listening to the crowd. If opponents scored a goal, a few people cheered. If Germany scored, the sidewalk erupted. Mounting tension toward the end of every match expressed itself in the wavering noise, and you could actually hear the ball approach a goal, or the release of pressure when it changed sides, or the sound of agony when a player missed a shot. To follow a good game, you didn't even need to watch TV. Germany advanced to the semifinals in 2014 to play Brazil, and I asked permission to watch. My body still felt the after effects of my week-long hunger strike. Not only had my muscles wasted, my immune system had broken down. Boils had grown on my skin from a staph infection, and I suffered some kind of cyclical fever. These afflictions possibly helped my case. Duhul consented, but no one knew what time the game would air. I stayed up for the early time slot, and the men let me sit, wearing chains, on a plastic chair in the doorway. But the early game was a rerun, so the men sent me to bed. In the morning, Bashko woke me up with exciting news.
"Michael," he said, "Germany, 7 points.
I scowled and shook my head. Obvious pirate bullshit. Who scored 7 goals in a professional soccer match?
7 points, he insisted. Brazil finished.
The story led the World Service. Germany had knocked out the host nation with 7 goals, humiliating Brazil while a billion people watched on TV. The sheer impertinence reminded people on the radio of the 1950 World Cup, also in Brazil, when a player from Uruguay hushed the vast crowd by scoring a goal against Brazil in the final minutes of the deciding match. The Maracanã Stadium, almost 200,000 people, fell silent. I heard an interview with the Uruguayan player as an old man on the BBC, and he gave a memorable summary of his own career. Only three people have silenced the Maracana, he said. Frank Sinatra, the Pope, and me. By now, some friends in Berlin were starting to wonder if I'd learned to sympathize with my pirates in the strange fashion of hostages who survive by adopting the viewpoint of their bullies. Therapists had named the Stockholm Syndrome after the behavior of Swedish captives in a bank robbery in 1973. The hostages defended the thieves' behavior to the police after a 6-day ordeal. It wasn't like that for me. Most of my comfortable and civilized self had stripped away, but the core of it, my will, had sharpened. I would have escaped in a second if I'd spotted a chance. My mother, in California, knew the World Cup was on, and she encouraged the FBI to suggest a military rescue during the tournament. She thought my guards might be distracted at night. Soccer is kind of universal, she said, so I figured they would be watching since they didn't have much else to do. She was right, but she didn't call the shots. Mom had no direct line to the president. I wrote a couple of letters to the White House, but I never heard back, she said, and after more than 2 years, this reticence upset her. I wouldn't have minded. I was sane enough to welcome another way out, but it was crucial, for my own mental health, to quit straining for vengeance. Stockholm Syndrome and forgiveness were not equivalent. I'd learned to forgive, but I hadn't forgotten the nature of the game. Germany advanced to the final, and guards let me sit in the plastic chair again, well after dark, in the doorway. I wrapped myself in a blanket and thought our festivities looked like a sinister imitation of a World Cup party in Berlin. 8 or 9 Somalis sat cross-legged on the cold patio, where no light shone but the flickering screen. Someone hung tarps across the arabesque arches of the patio to hide the TV glare, and Farhan passed around a plastic bottle with some bootleg gin. We kept it hidden from Duhul, who lounged at the front of the group with his wooden leg against the wall. During the game preview, the TV flashed an up-close shot of the actual trophy, the World Cup itself. Thick, molded gold and malachite. Duhul's hand reached up to swipe at it. His men laughed. I felt a wave of disgust. The gesture was pure instinct on Duhul's part. A thief wanted anything that glittered. Chapter 15. We moved back and forth between the houses, Duhul's and Abdi Yare's, throughout that summer. We never returned to the pirate villa, and Bashko insisted the reason was drones, but I think it had more to do with pirate gang politics because we heard furtive, indistinct humming at night, no matter where we lived. In late August, I woke up to hear that terrorists had decapitated a freelance journalist in Syria, James Foley, in a gruesome new style of video. For months, my radio delivered bizarre news about the Islamic State, which rose like a gas from the Sunni provinces of Iraq and Syria in 2014 to establish a patchwork caliphate where callow and criminal men tried to live without conventional law, like the pirates who had strung Raleigh from a tree and who, like their predecessors in Al-Qaeda, used Islam as a license for bloodthirstiness. I'd never heard of Foley. He'd been kidnapped in 2012 during my long news blackout, but his story sounded familiar. A freelance excursion to a dangerous country, some lapses in judgment, a world of shit. The radio report had me paralyzed. I didn't know yet that the image of a hostage in an orange jumpsuit in the desert, kneeling before a robed Islamic State executioner holding a knife, would become a new gauge of mayhem in the world, an updated emblem of entropy. News of Foley's execution agitated my guards. When Bashko brought my beans for breakfast that morning, he said, "Michael, James Foley, killed." I heard that. "Daesh, no good," he added. I didn't know the term, but to Bashko, the name Daesh was as common on the radio as Islamic State was to me. He explained the derogatory Arabic nickname. "Ah, okay," I said. "Fucking," I added. I must have looked angry and grim. "Adiga, no," he said, meaning it wouldn't happen to me. Until now, Al-Shabaab had expressed only a low-voltage desire to buy an American hostage. I hadn't been worth the money. Otherwise, Garfanji would have sold me in the 2 or more years since his threats in the wilderness. But when Daesh started to win territory and fame in the Middle East, there was a faction of Shabaab fighters who wanted to shift allegiance to them from Al-Qaeda, and one way to draw their attention was to behead an American. So, among certain members of Al-Shabaab, my market value went up, which may have encouraged one pirate faction to consider selling me off. Foley may have died under similar circumstances, kidnapped by one group but sold to murderous Islamists. Mom was sheltered from the worst possibilities by the FBI. She learned nothing of these nuances at the time, although she'd exchanged emails with Jim's mother, Diane, for moral support. Now Jim was dead. "When I first heard the news, I had a bad feeling," she said later. "Then I heard the name Foley." Mom, with a feeling of dread, had to send her condolences. The news in 2014 seemed to describe a new, wobbling 21st century world order. I heard about the rotting out of nation-states, the spread of transnational groups like the Islamic State and Boko Haram, which had started to dissolve borders in Africa and the Middle East, and mock the power of some national militaries as a mirage. Russia had invaded Ukraine, using the U.S. war in Iraq as a justification to ignore a sovereign country's borders. "Good," Bashko had said when he heard about Putin's annexation of Crimea. Entropy had picked up speed. A noticeable number of interviews on the BBC featured people from both the left and the right who ridiculed the idea of national sovereignty, as if old ideas naturally had to be dumped in the garbage. But it was hard to see a shimmering vision of justice and peace in the distance to replace these old ideas. Instead, the world was rolling back to factionalism, to violent opportunism, to old swamps of chaos and crime. One brilliant late summer morning, I plotted another hunger strike under my mosquito net while the radio murmured beside my ear. The net indicated my mood. When it was down during daylight hours, I felt depressed. Bashko sat alone in the room and watched me. "Sahib," he said. I glanced up. "Mango," he requested. I wanted nothing to do with Bashko today, but I sighed and crawled out from the net. I pulled a bottle from the clanking case of juice and tossed it to him. For this favor, I expected information. "News," I said. "No news, Sahib," he said. We had just moved back to Abdi Yare's house again. I felt weary and disgusted with the old routine. "This house, why?" I said. "I don't know, Sahib," he shook his head. "A nigga, no free." "Why?" I said. "No news," he repeated. I scowled and crawled back under my net. I resumed my position, one arm thrown over my face, listening to the radio, and this time I meant it as a direct personal snub. After a minute, Bashko hissed, "Hey, Michael," and waved at me to sit up. He did have news? I opened the mosquito net and sat on the edge of my mattress. Bashko told me a wild story. He said the guards would stop work if the bosses couldn't cut a deal. They were tired of changing houses, too. For 2 months, they'd received no allowance. "All group?" he said, meaning all the guards, "stop work." I nodded, uncertain of what to say. A labor strike? The BBC had recently mentioned a miners' strike in South Africa, so I said, for clarity, "South Africa, same-same?" "Yes," Bashko answered and laughed. I nodded again and asked if a hunger strike by the hostage would help. "Okay, Sahib," he lifted his thumb. "Slow, slow, 2 weeks." Chapter 16. Several days later, Abdinur, who was the senior guard, although he didn't act like it, came into my room and announced to Bashko and some other men that he had quit. Bashko celebrated, throwing his hands in the air. Evidently, Abdinur had told Abdi Yare on the phone about his intention to strike. Abdi Yare had fired him on the spot. For some reason, that was a good sign. The same evening, a car arrived in the darkened yard with an ominous rumble, and Abdinur disappeared. I found it blood-chilling. Bashko reassured me that the rest of the group would stay and guard me. By his reckoning, we were on the verge of freedom, but I didn't dare believe him. I saw no reason Abdi Yare couldn't replace the whole team one by one and leave me in the hands of new and more dangerous men. On the first day of September, Eunice came to squat beside my mattress. He said there would be a phone call to a man called Robert from the UN. He gave me a list of simple facts to mention and said, "Do not tell him where you are. I don't know where I am." What was going on, though? I wondered if Robert would be the same man who had failed to show up with a UN security team at the airport. Or if Robert was the real name of Romeo, the nickname of the calm-voiced negotiator Garfangi had called in the darkened bush over 2 years before. I decided to rehearse a few lines in German to describe my location. I concocted a sentence explaining that I was in a house near a mosque with a rather loud minaret, which I could see from my east-facing window. I practiced weaving it into English phrases for Robert so the Somalis wouldn't notice. My heart raced. Before lunch, Eunice ordered me to throw my blanket over my head. Six of us had to walk out and sit in a hot Land Rover in the courtyard with all the windows sealed. The call would be routed somehow from Mogadishu, and Abdiyari would listen in. The phone rang. Eunice spoke in rough Somali and handed it to me. "Michael, my name's Robert," said a self-assured but unfamiliar American voice. I answered a security question and gabbed about my health. Since Eunice had ordered me to be dramatic, I also gave my whereabouts in half-hollered, desperate-sounding German. It seemed to work. I got every bit of information out to Robert, or Bob, who I gathered was not from the UN, and I told myself that if the whole thing was a trick by the Pentagon, as Eunice half-believed, the Pentagon would have what it needed. Robert connected me somehow to my mother. She asked in an urgent voice how I was. "We're trying to get you out," she said. Hearing her again after 19 months was a miracle, a memory of a lost life, but I couldn't let it raise my hopes because her language hadn't changed. After all this time, she used the same questions and the same vague, encouraging optimism. I spent the rest of the day in a haze of panic and confusion. I couldn't tell whether negotiations had budged or how much German my pirates had detected. For lunch, Hashi cooked flat, crepe-like pancakes called anjero instead of pasta. I used the pancakes to sop up a potato and onion mixture with my hand. We'd been eating like this for weeks, if not months. The pirates had noticed that I refused plain spaghetti but didn't mind anjero. Bashko asked if I knew anjero from the United States. Yes, from Ethiopian restaurants. Their treatment of me, I thought, had improved since my week-long hunger strike. Maybe I'd convinced them I was crazy enough to commit suicide. Now Bashko watched me eat with wary, questioning eyes. He asked if my mother had promised a ransom. She hadn't mentioned money at all, but I said, "Of course." He seemed to relax. "Bashko," I said carefully between bites, "Abdiyari speak. Phone call good?" Did Abdiyari say it was a good phone call? Or, more to the point, "Are we cool even though I just ratted our location in German?" "Ha? Yes," he said. "Okay." I tried to relax, but couldn't. Chapter 17. The next morning, we heard on the radio that a leader of Al-Shabaab, Ahmed Abdi Godane, had been killed by a drone while his convoy paused near a village in southern Somalia. Godane had organized the siege of the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, where dozens of shoppers were slaughtered by Shabab terrorists in late 2013. The gunmen had ordered some of their victims to recite the Shahada before they died. "There is no God but Allah," so they could distinguish Muslims from Kufar. Bashko heard about the strike while he sat wrapped in a blanket beside his rifle. "Michael!" "Hmm?" He gleefully whispered the news about Godane's death, held up his thumb and smiled. "America good," he said. Later in the week, I woke up to an almost extraterrestrial noise over the courtyard, an electromagnetic hum, intense but unplaceable, and I wasted no time uttering a prayer in conversational German to describe my location to any nearby snooping drone. The guards mumbled to one another in the dark, and Bashko shuffled out to the courtyard. It occurred to me in a half-doze that he and I both had inconsistent views about military drones. As long as they helped us, we didn't mind. Bashko's rifle banged like a cannon, and I twitched in bed. The next morning, I asked why he'd fired his weapon. Bashko's typical answer to such a question would have been, "Because thief," meaning a stranger, some lurking Somali, or else flat denial. This time he told me, in a tense, excited whisper, that 5 drones had circled the house for 2 hours. He'd looked up to see faint lights reflected on a layer of cloud. The lights, he said, were blinking on top of the drones. He had noticed them only because of the weather. 5? I said skeptically, using 5 fingers. 5, he said, flashing the same gesture. I wondered if it was a fairy tale. Then I wondered if my German outburst on the phone had done some good. Then I wondered if we were all about to die in a raid. But Boshko didn't even wonder why the drones had paid a visit.
Because Adiga, he said.
Because of you.
No, I dissembled with a smile, because Al-Shabaab. We are in Haradiri, I said. Al-Shabaab is in Haradiri.
Okay, Sahib, he said. The whole month of September was a weird fog of rumor and fear. In spite of the new stirrings, I hoped for nothing, trusted nothing. I heard a rumor from the guards that someone had arrested Mohammed Garfanji in Mogadishu. Then I heard he'd gone free again. I mulled a hunger strike to force the boss's hand. But I wondered whether open defiance would worsen my situation. I thought a labor strike by the guards could easily bring a fire sale of the hostage to another pirate group, or even to Al-Shabaab, and if that was true, then a hunger strike might bring nothing better. The whole process could start over. The swirl of uncertainty nauseated me, and I put no faith in rumors of freedom. One morning in late September, the 23rd, Yunus came to my room with his phone for another conversation with Bob. This time he let us talk for 30 seconds.
Okay, do you have any idea what's going on? Bob said, and managed to explain exactly nothing before Yunus snatched the phone from my hand.
Proof of life only, he said, and I lost my temper. What the fuck are you doing? You should have let me finish.
Why? He said. Tonight you will go free.
If you're lying, Yunus, I swear I'll stop eating tomorrow.
That was a hot flash of temper. I tried to keep hunger strike plans to myself. Later, I caught Yunus joking about the conversation to Hashi, and I assumed he was proud of fooling me, of trying to raise my hope when my real fate was to be shifted like a sack of millet to some terrorist Land Rover. Around noon, I had to use the bathroom. Before I finished, the main compound gate swung noisily open, and a Land Rover rumbled into the yard. My limbs swamped with fear. Cars came at night, as a rule. Hashi stood outside the bathroom with his Kalashnikov and said,
Michael?
Gari.
Michael, your car is here.
What Gari? I'm busy.
No problem, he said.
My other guards buzzed in the hall like excited schoolboys. Abdul Rahman, the translator, Madobe, and a runner had arrived in the Land Rover with a sealed clear plastic sack of bound $100 bills.
You are going free, said Yunus when I came out.
I studied the bills to see if they were fake. Hard to tell. It was a lot of money, but Al-Shabaab would have paid in dollars too, not shillings. It says something about my flinty frame of mind that in spite of the cash, I couldn't believe I was about to go free. I'd shut down everything in self-defense, and I still had a hair-trigger temper, an animal mistrust of the mysterious changes upending my comfortable prison world.
You must pack your bags, Abdul Rahman said. You are going to the airport.
I dropped a few things into my faux leather bag in a desultory way and tied it all up with a dirty rope. The day felt bright and warm. I had time to make a journal entry. I'm sick and stuffed up, with clogged ears and blurred eyes, lungs full of bronchitis, and a heart full of rage. One of the guards had given me a bottle of potent Egyptian cough syrup to calm my bronchitis, or whatever it was, and help me sleep. I'd been sick for weeks. Boils thrived on my skin. By now, it just felt normal. I packed my notebooks away. No one seemed to care about them. A few men wanted to shake my hand. I submitted but looked away. I did believe I would never see them again, but I thought somebody else would just deliver me to another part of the bush and transfer me to a more dangerous gang. I climbed into the car with only Yunus and Abdul Rahman, the two translators. No weapons in sight. That was oddly encouraging. But when the car pulled out of the compound, Yunus changed his story.
We will not go to the airport now. We will give you to some other Somalis, he said, which was the wrong thing to say to a hostage in my frame of mind.
I nearly bit off his head, thinking, you just sold me to another gang. I felt blind with practiced mistrust, fierce as a cat piled into a traveling cage. The heat and dust of Galkayo seemed pleasant, though. I saw school compounds, semi-familiar houses, and medical clinics. Robed women with children moved along the road. Driving in a car without a tight contingent of armed men felt almost civilized, and it was such a surprise to see everyday life in a Somali town without squinting through a blindfold that I began to notice a different fear, an unexpected panic that all my wound-up defenses might be useless now. I might have to unwind. What if these guys are serious? The streets bustled with people and goats, and trees threw a spangled, fluttering shade. Plastic litter had collected around the bases of the houses and walls, which had painted advertisements and logos, and I wondered, with a stir of nausea, how it would feel to walk these streets like a normal man. I'd grown used to being a hostage, and I didn't know how to stop. We drove some distance into the bush, where a white sedan waited beside a gnarled acacia. "Get out,"